talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Thank you, Bethany.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.
KBOO is gearing up to celebrate 50 years of community radio, and we need your help. Take the Big Events survey on KBOO.fm and help us decide what kind of events you would attend or help build. Go to KBOO.fm and click on the survey banner to help prepare for the Kaleidoscope of KBOO, past, present, and future, 50th anniversary celebration.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lowellhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and salads. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland. LowellhurstTheater.com.
Welcome to a special year-end edition of The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today we're bringing you two of our favorite archival interviews.
John Waters, the Baltimore director famous for such transgressive films as Pink Flamingos and Hairspray, makes an annual pilgrimage to Portland for a holiday show like no other. I'll be asking him about this year's version of the John Waters Christmas show, and we'll talk about some of his adventures as an independent filmmaker.
But first, I want to turn to Oregon filmmaking that's brought about social change. One of the news stories I've been following lately involves inmates at Oregon's women's prison, the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. As of November last month, Coffee Creek was overcrowded, 35 inmates over its capacity of 1280 and its highest population ever. A big debate has been happening around whether or not to open a second women's prison at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. While prison overcrowding creates dangerous conditions for inmates and prison staff, many criminal justice reform advocates have opposed opening a new prison. Critics argue that instead of expanding incarceration, the state should focus on reducing the female prison population, in part through the use of programs that help lower recidivism. That means programs that help women stay out of prison once they leave. A couple years back, one such program, the Family Preservation Project at Coffee Creek, sat on the chopping block. The innovative program serves incarcerated mothers and helps them connect with their families and prepare for life after prison. In early 2015, the Department of Corrections prepared to cut the program due to budget cuts. Around that time, acclaimed Portland-based documentary filmmaker Brian Lindstrom released a film about women in the program called Mothering Inside. A few months later, the Oregon State Legislature passed a bill saving the program, putting it under the control of the YWCA of Greater Portland. It's hard to deny that Brian's film, sharing the successes of the program, played a role and made an impact. In January of 2015, Brian Lindstrom visited us in the KBOO studios and discussed his work and the impact the women in the Family Preservation Project had on him. I'm interested, first and foremost, in how you first became drawn to this program that your new film is about, the Family Preservation Project.
Mm-hmm. I read an article in The Scanner about 2 years ago, and I was just really fascinated by this idea of inmate moms and how their relationships with their children can be nurtured. It seems like such a, you know, primal, important bond, and I wanted to explore that. And the more I found out about the program, the more I just loved it. I was privileged to be invited in by Jessica Katz, who runs the program, to observe a day when the women were presenting genograms. And what that is it's basically kind of a family history, a kind of personal roadmap, if you will, that each of the women draws. And what it does is it really helps make visual the forces that have shaped their lives. And so when you see a family tree and you see that, you know, there's a history of addiction and incarceration and things like that, it kind of, in a way, takes the burden off of the individual a little bit, because they can look at patterns and see that it's not that they're, you know, quote, bad people, end quote, but they are people that made bad choices, and because of their certain genetic makeup and family history, they've landed in this place. Another thing that really drew me to this project was that the Family Preservation Project steps in and fills a gap that no one else fills. You know, these institutions, the Department of Corrections or whomever, they have very specific mandates, and sometimes things fall through the cracks. And one thing that has been consistently falling through the cracks are children of inmates. How are they served? Who can step up and do the work of, like, making sure the family that has taken in this child has enough gas money, for instance, to drive from, you know, Corvallis to Wilsonville or whatever the case may be? And FPP does that. They step in where no one else is, and they make sure that these kids get to the prison to visit their moms. And one thing that really just overwhelming and repeatedly almost brought me to tears is just the animal need that the kids and the moms have to touch each other. I mean, it's just incredible. They have these 3-hour visits, two Saturdays a month, and it's just like they're just all over each other in this really, you know, loving physical way. And they don't get to do that in the normal prison visit because there's plexiglass between them and there are all these rules. What FPP does is they take all that away and they make it a much more, you know, healthy thing where kids can dance and play and sing and run around and do all and eat with mom, and they get to cuddle and read together. And yeah, I just really feel like it's just like on a cellular level, just so important, not only for the child, but for the mom too.
Do you feel under the circumstances that this project for you has become like an advocacy film, like advocacy for the continuation of this program or programs like it?
Well, that's a great question, and I would say yes and no. The reason I say no is because as a filmmaker, sometimes an advocacy film has such an agenda that, you know, the audience is just kind of bombarded with this idea of, like, you know, kind of what to do, how to feel. This film is largely cinema verite, with the camera just being a fly on the wall. It's the film that I wanted to make. This wasn't me trying to, like, convince anyone of anything or, you know, trying to manipulate the footage in such a way. It was really just trying to let the story unfold and trying to let the audience have a kind of, you know, really bird's eye view of change and of women rebuilding their bonds with their children and of their children getting to see the women. And another thing FPP does is they facilitate phone conversations. And that is so huge. I mean, first of all, if the women are left to pay for it themselves, that's just prohibitively expensive. But FPP takes care of all that. And so you've got these scenes where, you know, the women are calling the kids, and it's more like, okay, have you done your homework? You know, how come you're not doing a better job brushing your teeth? I heard about this, you know, dental checkup, and I need you to floss. I mean, they're really, you know, mothering from the inside, like the title of the film, Mothering Inside. But FPP allows them to do that. And the benefits of that are so profound. And I think that's the question about, like, does it stop generational incarceration? You know, I think absolutely, because I think that these bonds that are being restored and built are going to make it much less likely that the offspring of these women will commit crimes and be incarcerated. And in fact, the program itself has a zero recidivism rate.
Really? Zero?
Yeah.
Wow. You know, I'm happy that you brought up cinema verite, because you have done a lot of cinema verite work, you know, as you mentioned, the fly on the wall style of, say, Frederick Wiseman, who has also filmed a lot in prisons. Finding Normal was shot this way, while Alien Boy was a departure from that style and really needed to be. It seems like you've returned to it. What do you like about shooting this way? On the one hand, it's removed, but on the other hand, it's really intimate. How does that help you honor your subjects?
There's an element of witness to cinema verite that I find very powerful. And I think that when people are involved with their whole being in the kind of sacred work of change, that there's something that they reveal about themselves. And a lot of people think, oh, well, aren't they, like, self-conscious and all that? And I think there might be an element of that, but I tend to shoot so much that I think I wear that out, and people kind of, you know, are revealed. I mean, I'm always just blown away by how natural and open people are, and especially when there's something, when the stakes are really high. You know, like in Finding Normal, you know, I mean, people are literally fighting for their lives, because we all know that addiction can result in death, and too often does. And so I'll never forget one time this guy came into the mentor office and just unloaded on David Fitzgerald, one of the wonderful recovery mentors, this incredible story about how he had been using, he was about to be put back in prison because of a dirty UA test, and he was going to maybe lose, obviously that he would lose custody of his child, and what was he going to do? And all the time I would ask people beforehand if I could film them, you know, and the circumstances of his situation were such that he just came in and started talking. So I had to like ask him after the fact, hey, is it okay if I film you? And he said, dude, you're the least of my worries. And I think that, I mean, there's an element of that too. You know, when people are really, you know, fighting for their lives, you know, they've got other things to worry about besides me.
Is there any footage that you can think of, I mean, without spoiling anything, that you can think of that really, really struck you as powerful?
So there are these intense 3-hour visitations, and the women and the kids are all, you know, together, and there's so much like physical expression of love and just longing. And at the end of that, the women have to walk out to the yard, and they say goodbye to their kids. And one of the women, Nova, told her son, you just have to worry about being a second grader, which to me was just like, wow, you know. In other words, just the things that these families and these kids are having to deal with, and just to remind your kid, you just worry about being a second grader.
Right, like you continue to be a kid and
exactly,
I'll take care of the rest.
You know, it was a powerful moment and just kind of made clear to me, what this program is all about. You know, let those kids be kids again. And I think the FPP allows that by letting the moms be moms again.
Again, that was Brian Lindstrom, the acclaimed Portland documentary filmmaker behind Mothering Inside, about the Mothering Program Family Preservation Project at Oregon's Women's Prison, the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility.
You're listening to our end of the year film show special on KBOO. I'm SW Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. We'll be bringing you our monthly film calendar in just a few minutes, but first, here's Conch with a special holiday interview.
Yes, I'm on the phone with a legendary filmmaker, author, hitchhiker, and raconteur. He's coming out to Portland for an annual event, the John Waters Christmas Show. John Waters, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me, and I'm looking forward to coming back. I feel like Santa Claus on Groundhog Day. I do the show there every year.
Yes, you do like to tour around the U.S. I mentioned the hitchhiking. You've got a recent book called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. And you also have a Valentine's show, but the John Waters Christmas show is the real draw.
It's one that I rewrite every year, and it's funny because I do it, and I rewrite it in July in Provincetown when I'm there, so I don't have to have, you know, I'm always updating it because, as we know, things change every day. But certainly it's got a lot of new material in it from last year, but it's great. You know, it's such a wonderful audience that comes to the Aladdin. It's really exciting to come back every year. Portland is a little like Baltimore. People there now that live there say it isn't anymore, they try to say, but Baltimore isn't like Baltimore anymore either.
Well, some people credit you with making Baltimore a popular place to film. I mean, there are TV shows there like The Wire and Homicide, and of course, big budget films. Barry Levinson, that Johnny Come Lately became the darling back in the. I'm joking, but
he made Diner pretty soon after, and actually, a lot of the people that worked for me then started to work for him. He hired almost all my crew and my casting design, Pat Moran. So he and Vincent Perenio, who did all my sets. So he was great. He hired all my people. It was wonderful.
Well, you have been using Baltimore as a backdrop since the 60s when you were a teenager first using a camera. You've never felt the urge to go Hollywood.
Well, I got the money from Hollywood. I almost never got the money in Baltimore, but, sometimes I did. But, no, it doesn't matter, really. I filmed them here. I went to Hollywood to get the money, certainly for Polyester On, all those movies. Certainly the movie didn't come from Baltimore. But, yes, in the early days, I raised it from my friends and my family, and they all got their money back. I all paid them back. I don't know if the studios got all their money back for my later movies because they cost so much more. They're all still playing. They're all still getting their money back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of wondering whatever happened to revival theaters. You know, you hardly ever...
They're back in a way because Multiple Maniac's a movie that I made like 47 years ago. This fall was released by Janus Films, and Criterion's putting out the fancy restored DVD later in the year. So it did come back. Revival houses. I think they're coming back a little more. I think calendar houses are maybe a thing of the past. That's where every day there was a different double feature. But revival houses are back in some ways, or at least one screen in the house is a revival house.
Yeah, there used to be the ones, I remember when I was growing up in the 80s, I could hop in a bus. There were two or three theaters that were having something new every day. Stanley Kubrick, Hal Ashby, Werner Herzog. So, and it was at one of those theaters that I first saw Pink Flamingos as a teenager. I actually faked an ID to get in.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, I did the same thing before I made Pink Flamingos. I used to hook school and go down and see all the exploitation movies and the nudist camp movies and the Herschel Gordon Lewis, bless his soul, all his movies. He just passed away recently with no gore in his death, I'd like to point out.
That's good. Well, you know, I mean, people have Netflix and YouTube and Fandor these days, but I don't know, it just seems
that's
like...
That's okay. My movies are some on them, too. I don't care how you watch movies as long as you watch them.
But, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, is it sad that there's no Oddball Uncles to take you to a Buster Keaton festival these days? You know, it's hard to find good curated content outside of a film school.
But your Oddball Uncle shows you something online now. I don't think kids are having any less fun than we did.
Okay. Well, you know, here's a fun fact. I heard that you taught a film appreciation class for several years, and it was at a maximum security prison in Maryland, Paxatent.
Yes, I did. I wrote about that in one of my books, Crackpot.
Yes.
I still visit people in prison.
All the inmates were considered emotionally disturbed. Of course, I mean...
Yeah, part of the therapy was me. And I think it was effective in a weird way. After I showed them Pink Flamingos, they all said... You know, they were all really uptight. They thought I was crazy, and they were the ones that were in for criminal offenses. But I think it was actually good therapy in a way. We talked about what is taboos, what can you get away with, what, you know, you can't judge other people till you know the whole story and everything. So actually, Pink Flamingos is weirdly politically correct. Divine was at home, really, you know, resting on his laurels when he was attacked by someone who was jealous and wanted to take over their fame. So that's a story that prisoners have to deal with.
You know, honestly, I think now, when I went to Pink Flamingos, it was weird. There were people walking out in the first 5 minutes. This is when Miss Edie was sitting in her playpen shouting about eggs. Well, Divine...
They had a low threshold.
Yeah, right, right. But Divine really kind of paved the way for characters like Walter White. I mean, Divine was competing for filthiest person alive, but she had style where the other people didn't, so you're rooting for her and her family.
Well, I think also Divine made all drag queens kind of hip today. Most all drag queens have an edge today. All the ones on RuPaul's shows don't want to be Miss America or their mother, which was like when I was young. So basically, I think Divine did make kind of all drag queens a little cooler. So I think that's why people... I just was out at her grave the other day, and it was because it was Divine's birthday last week, and so many people had left stuff and everything. It was very touching.
You know, back in the 80s, I saw an interview David Letterman did with you. I wish I had a recording of it. You know, you tell Dave about getting back in town, getting back to Baltimore from a tour and hopping in a cab. And the cabbie says to you something like, "How about them birds?" And your response was along the lines of, "Well, I assume he was talking about the Orioles, but why would I be interested? Do I ask him about the films of Fassbender?"
Well, it's true. Just because I'm a man, why do you assume that I would follow that? The same way I don't assume that you would have my interest. I still feel that way. And sometimes in Baltimore, I have a purple scarf, and I wore it recently. People said, "Yeah, I feel the same way about the Ravens." I thought, "Oh, my God, they think I'm a Ravens fan because it's purple, so I can never have to put the scarf away and take it to another city." I'm against the Ravens, but I particularly don't follow them, but I'm not against people that do or anything. But at the same time, I do resent it when someone, because I'm a man, thinks that we have that in common.
It's presumptuous.
Yes, it is.
Well, talking about Christmas here, because you're a big fan of Christmas.
Well, I'm a big fan of the excess of Christmas.
Right.
How it affects people. I mean, I'm like a drag queen on Halloween. If it's Christmas, I'm always working. I feel like Johnny Mathis and I will be the last two people doing a Christmas circuit. But still, I do actually like it in real life. But then when I'm touring, I kind of, you know, I'm doing 18 cities in 23 days, so I think, oh, God, this really is Christmas. I have to go Christmas shopping. You know, I keep thinking it as material rather than an event that I, too, have to participate in.
Well, you know, when I think of Christmas, okay, I think of the pinnacles of Western art, like Bruegel and Botticelli and Handel, and then also the most outrageous kitsch, like animatronic elves and reindeer and light-up snowmen. So in these days, if you go to any museum, the mashup of high and low art is all the rage. But, you know, 40, 50 years ago, this was just something you and your friends were doing instinctively at Little Dreamland Studios in Baltimore, you know, mashing up high and low art.
Well, I think that is true. We were trying to make exploitation films for art theaters, and I think I succeeded in that. And I always was embarrassed. My films did not play in real grindhouses and drive-ins. They didn't work. They'd play them, and the audience would hate them because they didn't want irony in their films. When people saw Wes Meyer's real audience, they thought those films were really sexy. They didn't think they were funny. The early horror movies and the gore movies, they thought they were scary. Nobody was laughing. It was later when hipsters and intellectuals laughed. And that was why in Pecker I had a toast to the end of irony, because in a way, irony is snobbery.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, people look at the effects of a few years ago, like there's something to be ashamed of, and then look at the effects that were done, you know, 100 years ago back in the teens and 20s as if they're wonderful and groundbreaking. It's pretty strange.
I asked a child when I was trying to make conversation about movies we were talking about. I said, did you like The Wizard of Oz? And he said, no, basically it was just walking. And I thought, oh my God, that's such a great answer. But yes, today the effects in The Wizard of Oz are pitiful to a young person.
Well, you know, I just want to mention your books include Shock Value, Role Models, and Crackpot. My mom gave me a copy of Crackpot years and years ago for Christmas, and I immediately flipped to the chapter where the Christmas tree has just fallen on your grandmother.
Right.
And it's a weirdly atavistic scene. You write about how gleeful this made you, just dancing and...
Well, I talk about that at my Christmas show. I'm basically from touring with the Christmas show. Many people have told me about their horrible stories of Christmas trees falling over in their house. And it is generally involves liquor or dogs and cats. And it happens really a lot, so I think you should rig your own tree to fall over. Then it's really exciting. Everybody can scream and laugh, and you can take pictures of everybody pinned under the tree. It's exciting.
Now, why don't you rig one on stage while you're there? I think
that'd
be good.
Yeah, they should.
I understand that scene was the one that inspired a scene in Female Trouble. Divine plays a character named Dawn Davenport, who is disappointed about not getting cha-cha heels for Christmas and knocks the tree over on her grandmother. So, you know, art imitates life.
I didn't knock it over on my grandmother, but it did fall on her. She thought it was funny later that I had used that as inspiration. But, you know, one thing I'd like to settle, drag queens always think they know what cha-cha heels are, and a lot of times they have cha-cha heel contests. I've been when I appear. Cha-cha heels are not real high heels. It's a drag mistake. Cha-cha heels are short, squat, little heels. They're not high heels. I want to make sure that drag queens understand that.
Good for dancing.
Yes, or cha-cha. That's why they're called that. You could cha-cha in them.
Now, for those of us who grew up on advent calendars, I heard somewhere that you once made a custom version, open each window of each day, and there's one of your heroes, Ramona Africa, James Baldwin, various characters.
Yes, that is true. Yes. Don Knotts, Sonny Ray. Yes, I did do that. That was exciting. Every year I design a Christmas item that goes out. Matter of fact, I just signed all 2,000 of them. They're downstairs. I'm not going to tell you what it is. But every year I've done one for maybe 25 years at least. One year I had a clear plastic Christmas ball that had a plastic roach in it. And many people thought it was real when they opened the present because they would throw the ball and everything. So I had the advent calendar maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, I have to ask you, so you said, okay, you like coming out to Portland. I mean, Portland in December it's dark, it's soggy. Any special people or places or landmarks that you like to visit to get out of the rain?
Bookstores, I like that. Of course, you have great bookshops. But to be honest, when I'm in town, I don't have a chance to do anything. I'm in a different city every day. So I go to the hotel. My flight is a lot of times 6 in the morning or something, so I get picked up sometimes at 5 a.m. So I go to sleep and I get there in the afternoon when I check in, and then I rehearse a little and then usually sign books or whatever I'm selling for merchandise, and then do the show, and by then it's over. So I know in Portland every year usually I've walked over to Powell Books, and there was another bookshop that I don't think's there anymore that specialized in vintage porn and stuff, which is a great store. But somebody told me it's gone. I don't know. Yeah.
We are kind of known as a film town, so there's that, too.
Well, it's a film town, definitely, but it's also a book town, too, I think, in a way.
Well, John Waters, it's been a thrill having you join us on KBOO. And
thank you. I'm glad to be back. I'm looking forward to coming back.
Yeah, we'll look forward to seeing you in Portland, or maybe not. Your shows sell out so fast.
Well, you never know, but ho, 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 as Santa would say.
And next year, you'll have to come out to the KBOO studios. It'll be your favorite new place, especially late at night. It's like meeting the cast from one of your early films.
Oh, okay. All right, we can win a date with me or something.
There you go. Well, thanks again, and happy holidays.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Conch speaking with filmmaker John Waters. You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. And now here's a few local events coming up in the next month. Tonight, Thursday, December 22nd at 7:30 p.m., the Hollywood Theater will host Queer Horror for the holidays. It's the annual short film showcase of the bi-monthly Queer Horror program, which is hosted by drag clown Carla Rossi and questions horror's relation to queerness and what it means to identify with the monster. Tonight's event will feature films by amateur and established filmmakers. More info at queer-horror.com. The Hollywood Theater will also kick off 2017 with its New Year's Day Hong Kong-a-thon, with 35mm prints of three Hong Kong film classics. On January 1st, Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon will start at 2 p.m., followed by Ricky O, The Story of Ricky, at 4:15, and John Woo's The Killer at 6:15. Details at hollywoodtheater.org. On January 10th, local film collective Cinema Project continues its winter screening series with the 7 p.m. screening, A German Youth. It's the debut feature of European filmmaker Jean-Gabriel Perriot, and it's a mosaic of archival footage about the leftist German group, the Red Army, or the Bader-Meinhof Gang. Presented in collaboration with the Northwest Film Center at the Witzel Auditorium. More info at cinemaproject.org. From January 13th through February 5th, the Northwest Film Center will present its 34th annual Real Music Festival. The annual celebration of sound, music, and image will feature over 20 films, new works, and classics. Details about films, showtimes, and more at nwfilm.org. On January 16th, the Clinton Street Theater will present its annual tribute to Martin Luther King. At 7 p.m., they'll screen the landmark documentary King, A Filmed Record, from Montgomery to Memphis. More info at cstpdx.com. And that just about wraps it up for the film calendar and for this month's edition of The Film Show on KBOO. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm S.W. Conser. Thanks again to our guests today, filmmaker John Waters and documentarian Brian Lindstrom.
Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web.
The audio for this show will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter at @KBOOFilmShow.
Now, stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station, KBOO.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, your community radio station. Stay tuned for the World Beat Connection.